Sermon text for this morning will come from Luke chapter 15. I'll be reading verses 11 through 32. So if you've got your Bibles with you, Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. It reads there, Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything there, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I'm starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, put the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let us have a celebration, a feast. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he is back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. Well, when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" I think you can't help but, when you read a story like that, think of parents, fathers, and sons, and relatives. Think of my dad a few times, whom I love very much. I'm grateful for what he gave me, but at the same time, I have to admit, my most awkward pastoral counseling moment came with my dad. My dad, my grandmother, and myself, we all have this terrible thing, this disease, I guess you'd call it. It's hereditary. We all buy terrible cars on a regular basis. You know, we've just never been good at. My grandma started with it, and then my father, and then me. You know, in high school, my father picked out my car. Just barely, you have to have Scotty from Star Trek in the back. You know, "We're barely hanging in there, Captain. We're going to make it today." Didn't turn right, you know. "Dad, why were you late for school?" "Well, school's on the right-hand side, Dad. I don't know how to turn left all the way around." We weren't. And my dad, at some point in my life, at a point where all the kids were graduated from college, I was in seminary on scholarship. He had gotten us all through college. He'd done his part. And he was at that stage of life. He probably could have bought himself a nice car and enjoyed it, you know, kind of that stage. All his friends had done that same thing. And this time in his life, he's driving this ugly electric blue Ford. You know, he's driving it around left and right, and those kids would just be merciless to him. "Dad, you got to get something. You got to upgrade a little bit. Get something a little bit nicer." No, he loved this ugly electric blue Ford. He'd be driving left and right. And here's the pastoral counseling moment we had. It was my second year of seminary. He calls me up. It's about 10 a.m. Chicago time, 8 a.m. Seattle time. So he's just gotten up. And I say, "Hey, Dad, how's it going?" And he's excited. He's like, "Hey, you'll never guess what happened." I say, "Oh, well, what happened, Dad?" And he said, "The blue Ford got robbed this morning. Got stolen." I say, "All right, Dad. Hey, one question. Why are you excited about that, Father?" And he said, "Because you kids always told me that car was worth nothing, but to somebody it was worth something." And so I stop and I say, well, Dad, I celebrate with you your car getting stolen this morning. Finish talking. He calls me up about 2 hours later and he's sad. And I say, well, Dad, what's going on? Why are you sad? And they said, well, the police found my car. I say, okay, Dad, isn't this a good thing? And most, you know, why are you sad? The police found your car. And he said, well, apparently they had only made it a few blocks before it broke down and the robbers had to bail on it. And so I had to pray with him, Father, I'm sorry that your car was recovered. I apologize. I know my parents listen to the podcast. Dad, if you're listening now, I apologize. I love you very much. But I'm going to tell that story the rest of my life in ministry. I hope you just understand that. It's too good not to pass along. I tell you that story because each one of you in this congregation has similar family stories. Each one of you in the congregation, you might not believe it, but if we got you to a nice dinner, or if we got you to a festive party, or if we were at a celebration, you would have stories about your family, some positive that would come out, some funny, some hurtful. But you've got them. And as we transition into the season of Lent, we've been talking about stewardship. And before this, we'd been talking about sort of the, I don't know if I'd call it the universal aspects of stewardship, because everybody has to deal with family, but I guess sort of the big picture in terms of stewardship of worship and stewardship of service and stewardship of spiritual gifts. And now it's time to get into the more tangible, okay, the here and now. How do you deal with the things that you got to deal with 8 to 5, and in the case of family, 24/7? So today we talk about stewardship of family, and our guide is going to be the parable of the prodigal son. I do need to make one quick note. I know on your bulletin it says stewardship of work and family, and kind of in the middle of the week decided to just focus on family. It was sort of biting off more than I can chew. So if you were excited to hear about work, I know you all have to go to work on Monday, so you can't be that excited to hear about work. But if for some reason you were excited to hear about work, I apologize, but I think some of this stuff will apply to what you're talking about, work. We all have positive memories of our families, but many of us have negative memories of our families. We need to be honest about those things, and I think the parable of the prodigal son will do that. We'll find that some of us act like the younger son, some of us act like the older son, and we all need to get better at acting like the father. So let's jump into the text a little bit here. The story begins, a man has two sons, and his younger son comes up to him and says, hey, Dad, I'd like my inheritance now. I think that's fairly straightforward. You know, he's asking, Dad's got X amount of money, and as soon as he dies, he's going to pass it on to his two kids. But it's a little bit of an awkward thing to ask. I mean, you can kind of imagine if your kids were sort of hovering over your will every 2 minutes or something like that, you'd be saying, I want to give you something, but what is this? That's odd. And in this culture, it's really rude. It's considered basically like the son said, hey, Dad, I wish you were dead. I'm ready to take over. You're worthless to me. So the son comes up and he really gives a cheap shot to his father. He says, God, I want my inheritance now. You got no honor in my sight. And as I might get a few amens from the audience, dad becomes an ATM machine for him. Some of you know what it's like to have your kids be the ATM machine for you. Oddly enough, the father grants the wish. He says, okay, here you go, here it is. Jesus' audience must have been shocked because Deuteronomy 21 said, kill this kid, stone this kid if he's that rebellious. But the father grants the wish. The son goes and he finds the whatever the Las Vegas of the ancient Near Eastern world is, and he wastes all the money away. He finds himself with nothing and he has to get a job, and he gets a job working as a pig farmer, which in the Jewish culture, again, working with pigs is the lowest that you could possibly do. So he's at his lowest possible state, and he's even to the point where he's so hungry he would eat what the pigs would eat. And all of a sudden he has an epiphany. You know what? My dad wasn't that bad, all said and done. Funny how we have, you had the kids in the last year of high school talking to you how evil you are, and then that first year of college when they're all alone, oh, Dad, I love you so much, I miss you. So he humbles himself, which is good, and he decides to return to the father. But he decides to return to the father for money, which is bad, or for a job. The younger son's stewardship of family is that family is a means to an end. Understand what I'm saying? The younger son sees that family is something you use to get something else. Some of us approach family like the younger son. We have these necessary things that we have to do in order to get what we want, and so we use our family members in that capacity. Now you're jumping in your mind, you're saying, okay, I guess I can kind of picture something like that. And you say, I know crazy Uncle Leroy, he's coming on Thanksgiving, and he's kind of an annoying, awkward guy, and he's going to have a business proposition this Thanksgiving. I'm going to have to turn him down yet again. He's going to be asking for startup money. I'm going to have to turn him down yet again. You say, okay, that's what I picture when I picture a family member that's using me as a means to an end. But it goes deeper than that. It goes much deeper than that. At all levels of the family cycle, we are tempted to use family as a means to an end. A few weeks ago, I was on a flight from Chicago to Dallas, and you know you get to read the magazine is for the particular airline because you're waiting forever on the tarmac. I go through the magazine, and this is just sort of a personal pet peeve of mine, but I read the, it's written for the business executives, but the matchmaking professionals there are in the airplane magazines for business executives. And I think what kind of aggravates, you know, they're talking about matchmaking, and they use phrases that just scare me. They say, you don't have the time or the patience to find somebody out there. Let us do it for you. And I'm thinking, well, if you don't have the time or the patience, how are you gonna be in relationship with somebody like that? You need visible, you know, you need somebody of your caliber. You need somebody of your level. You don't need to waste your time with other people or anything like that. And you're just sitting there and you're saying, well, is that how you view relationships as this means to an end? And finally, this one I saw in Chicago to Dallas, I had to write down. I couldn't believe it. But it went something like this. It was a testimony of a man who had used this matchmaking dating service. And he said, you know, I'm a hardworking business executive. I don't need to waste my time with other people. I deserve to have my wish list come to life. And he said, is that so wrong? And I'm sitting on the plane saying, yes, that's wrong. People are not wish lists. People are not wish lists coming to life. But we treat people like they're the ends. At the end of life, we do the same thing. One of the hardest counseling situations I've ever been in my life is counseling people to move to a nursing home, if they're talking to their parents about moving to a nursing home. The reason it's so hard is this. From the parents' point of view, they just want to live in the house they've always known. From the kids' point of view, they say they just want a little bit of peace. I mean, I don't want to have to be worried about my parent left and right. Both sides have good reasons for what they do, but neither side can understand each other. Even in a good situation, it's tough. The reason is because we'll often use people as ends, means to an end. Our church family. I saw an article online this week about networking, going to church to network for a new job. Talked about how great it was. There was this great place called church where you could meet outlets and resources and all sorts of things. My friends, if you are unemployed or searching for a job, I hope we can be a place where we pray for you and walk beside you and encourage you. But I certainly hope you're not coming to church just for networking purposes. You're missing the big picture. You don't believe me. I know some of you don't believe me. Okay, let me give you an example from our national news if you don't believe me. There is a word in the English language that meant absolutely nothing to many of you until a month ago. Now, as soon as I say it, each one of you is going to have a position, an opinion, a point of view, and each one of you is going to get an emotional reaction. All right? You know what that word is? Octuplets. Octuplets. Didn't mean anything until a month ago, and then a Southern California woman sparked a huge ethics debate. Are these kids a gift from God, or is this medical ethics gone awry? Did this woman seek kids to love them, or because she needed them? Were the kids a means to an end? Now, I don't know. I'm not her pastor. I'm not going to judge, and I would encourage you not to judge. I just encourage you to look in the mirror and say, do we do the same thing sometime? Is it ever possible that in the suburbs we've used our kids as a means to an end? You had little Tiffany. You put her in a cheerleader outfit because you always wanted to be a cheerleader, right? Halloween came. She wanted to be a ghost. Oh, no, little Tiffany, you're going to be a cheerleader. Little Tyler, you wanted him to be a football player. You put that helmet on him when he was just 2 years old. He's in his little baby seat with the helmet on. He came home one day with a clarinet because he wanted to be in marching band. Oh, he was grounded for life. You are a football player. You got to ask yourself, and I'll never claim, those of you who knew, I'm a single man, I don't have kids. So I don't claim to know what it's like with parenting, but I can claim some theological truths, and one is this, that if you are preventing your kids from making the same mistakes you made, that's good. But if you are using your kids to make up for the mistakes that you made, that's a sin. And the line is pretty thin in between those two. The younger son's mistake is that his father is a means to an end. If family is simply a means you use to get to another goal, and if you do that, you're not being a good steward of the family. We jump ahead to the older son. We don't hear much about the older son until the younger son comes home. But when we do hear from him, we learn one simple thing. He's mad. Why is he so frustrated? Well, you might think it was because of the money. I mean, you know, does he have to split his money again with his younger son? But the end of the text makes it clear that he doesn't. You might think that maybe he just doesn't like his younger brother and he's just angry and he enjoyed the peace he was had. Those of us who are middle or younger children might sarcastically say, well, this is just a typical older sibling. You know, they lose attention just for 1 second and they throw a fit. They can't complain. See, I mean, must have a lot of older kids in the audience. Nobody's laughing at that. It seems to be his argument is that anyone who doesn't follow the rules doesn't deserve to be in the family. Anyone who doesn't follow the rules doesn't deserve to be in the family. If the younger brother saw family as a means to an end, the older brother sees family as an end in and of themselves. Another way to put it, the older brother is that type of person that has to have everyone in his family lined up, and there's no room for error whatsoever. Now you say, well, that doesn't happen all that much. I say, hold on now. We church folk often suffer from the older brother syndrome. If you had kids, and you brought them to church one day, and let's say you got a terrible idea, but let's say at 12 years old, you decided that you were going to give your kids the college savings. All the money you'd saved up for college, you said at 12 years old, they're ready to spend it, and so you gave it to them. And sure enough, a week later, you got thousands of dollars worth of Jonas Brothers material that you don't need. And everybody at church is saying to you, that was terrible parenting. And probably right, I mean, they should say to you, that's terrible parenting. You know, rightly. Right? So if you do what the younger son does, you're going to get called a terrible person. But what happens if you do what the older son does? What happens if you work your kids to perfection, if you line them up with extracurricular activities to the point they're stressed and you're stressed? What happens if you come to church and you put on this facade that your families are perfect? You're pretending to have everything together, but you don't really. What happens when that happens? We applaud. We in the church congratulate that. We say that's a good thing, when really that's the sin of the older brother. The older brother's behavior often leads to a cycle, and I don't know how many of you have seen this, but it's heartbreaking. You see, they have somebody in their life that they're tired of, and they're sick of obeying the rules while this other person in their life is not, and so they cut that person off. It starts with crazy Uncle Leroy. You say, I'm done with it. I'm done with the Thanksgivings where you hit me up with a business proposition. I'm done. I'm just not calling you anymore. I cut you off. People around you congratulate you, said, yeah, you put up good boundaries. It's a good person. You've done a great thing, right? Then it continues. Someone a little bit closer to the family that still isn't perfect, they cut them out. They say, well, this person, you know, it's been tough to get in touch with this person. They say, this person, well, they just kind of get on my nerves sometimes, so they cut that out. And then all of a sudden they go through one more stage. Then someone in the immediate family isn't good enough. You're upset with the choice your son made. Your father's still gotten on your case. Your brother is this, your sister is that. Whatever it is, we decide, okay, it's not worth it for them to be in the family anymore. We cut them out. And before we know it, we're just like the older brother. We're standing outside by ourselves while everybody else is having a party. And the reason is because we decided that we had to be perfect and everyone around us had to be perfect and there was no room for grace. We all know people who haven't spoken to each other for years because their parents or their siblings or the vast majority of time, it seems like it was rooted in this older brother attitude. You can't live up to my expectations. You can't live up to my expectations. My friends, I'm all for family values. I believe in tough love at times, but I'm telling you, if you're striving for perfection, you're going to go nuts. If you are striving for perfection in your families, you're going to go nuts. That's the sin of the older brother. He took in his role as the perfect family member so seriously that he's written off his younger brother, and it gets to the point where he can't even see his younger brother's redemption when it takes place. Isn't that the truth? Sometimes you turn your life around, the very first people that don't understand you are your family. They want to hold you back. That's what the older brother does. He uses his family as the end, the ultimate judgment for if I was successful or not in life. If you can't use your family as a means to an end, and you can't use your family as the end, what do you do? And this is the point in the text in which the father figure enters. We know just a bit about the father, that he gave into his son's wishes, and that as soon as the son came back, he welcomed him into the home. In fact, the text says that he went running out to his son, and in that culture, running would have been very shameful. Obviously, this father was proud to have his son back. First conclusion you might come to is that the father is a pushover, and probably Jesus here has thought that. You know, here's a guy that gives away all his money, and then as soon as his son comes back, well, he's just a bleeding heart that goes out and running to him. But that would be missing the point just slightly. Just slightly. See, a pushover lets somebody do exactly what they want, and in this case, the son wanted to just work as a servant. So if the father was a pushover, he would have let the son stay filthy and work as a servant. The father's not content with that. The father's not content until the son is always who he's supposed to be. He puts a robe and a ring on the son and makes sure that the son lives up to the role that he expects. You see, my friends, good stewardship of family is not using them to get something else, nor is it the fruitless quest for perfection. Good stewardship is being able to see the moments of grace amidst the mess. Good stewardship is being able to see family amongst the filthy. Friends, everybody has difficulties. Sometimes we think to ourselves that in the Christian walk, Christian families should be perfect and non-Christian families should be the ones that are messed up. That's entirely wrong. Non-Christian families should be messed up. Christian families should be messed up. Christian families should have this moment of grace that brings new life into the family. Every parent drives their teen nuts. Do you know that? Every teenager, I just want you to know, at some point you thought your parent was a fascist dictator. That's normal. The question is, do you see the grace? Every parent in this room, your teen drives you nuts. At some point, you are convinced that your child is the Antichrist. I want you to know, that's normal. The question is, do you see the grace? Every sibling is going to make you jealous at some point. They're going to come up with a job just as you get that job promotion that's better than yours is. You're going to be driven nuts by that. But there are going to be beautiful times in the midst of that. Can you see the opportunities for grace? Every spouse, as much as you dream they'd be a wish list come to life, is going to let you down at some point. Every spouse cannot be the perfect person to meet all of your needs at once. But there's still going to be love and beauty there. Can you see the grace? Every family's going to have that meal where it seems like everybody's mad at everybody. That's not unusual, folks. That's life. You think, oh, I'm the only crazy one on my block that this happens to. No. It happens to all of us. The question is, once the tempers are done flaring, and once the evil words have been said, and once the commotion has died down, in your family, is there still room for redemption? In your family, is there still room to welcome somebody with open arms? In your family, is there still room for grace? My guess is that every family goes through a moment, at least once in their lives, where they are the talk of the entire neighborhood, for good or for bad. Stewardship of family means being honest with each other when we think we're perfect. When the neighborhood's talking about how great we are still a safe place to say, you know what, we have our own faults and our own flaws. But stewardship of family also means that when the entire neighborhood's talking about how crazy we are, that we still have the grace to love each other, even though they don't see it. We're gracious with each other when other people think that we are a mess. I'd like to give you one last final word, especially if you're sitting here and you come from a background, if you had a difficult family, is that I've used this parable to preach about family, but the parable in and of itself is not first about family. It's first about a loving God that cares about you. In fact, the parable is about the God who runs to you. Now, I know in these times you're thinking to yourself, well, I'm not who I was a year ago. My 401k is not where it was a year ago. Our God runs to you. The news headlines are not what they are a year ago. That doesn't matter. That's because we're printing the wrong news headlines. The right news headlines is that our God runs to you. My kids aren't quite who I thought they were. That's all right. The God in heaven who will help you with your kids is running to you. I feel an emptiness in my heart and I don't know if it will be filled. No, the God of the universe who loves you very much is running to you. You have to understand, in stewardship of family, you can only do so much and then you're going to mess up. And when you fall down, and when you mess up, and when you hurt somebody, you think you're done. And that's exactly the moment that the God we love is running to you to pick you right back up. Put a robe on you, put a ring on you, and say, you are still my child. And that's the parable of the prodigal son. We're going to go to communion in a second. And in communion, you're going to take just a very small cracker and grape juice. You're going to say, well, this Pastor Mark talks about this being a feast. It doesn't seem like that much of a feast, but you have to understand what's behind it. And what's behind it is not only the God who runs to you, but the God who sent his son from heaven to earth for you to sacrifice himself for you in hopes that you and the God of the universe could be one again. And we celebrate that today. Good stewardship of our family means understanding who we are. It means understanding that people are not a means to an end nor an end in and of themselves, but that this whole world is an opportunity to be redeemed, and it can start with your family. Amen.